We're in a series called The Belief Project. The Belief Project is a journey through the Gospel of John. John says at the very end of his book that he's written everything in the story of Jesus so that you might believe, and by believing you might have life in his name. So we're taking a journey through the Gospel of John to understand what does it mean to believe, and through believing, what does it mean to have life in Jesus. The Gospel of John is written by one of the best friends of Jesus. It's an insider's perspective of the story of Jesus, the life of Jesus. So what John has to say is very valuable for us because he's writing from an insider's perspective. It's up close and personal, the life of Jesus. I don't know what your best friends would say about you. Maybe some good, some bad, and some ugly. But we want to hear from one of the best friends of Jesus, John, the gospel writer, and what he tells us about Jesus. So we're going to be in chapter 6 today, one of my favorite stories in the Gospel of John. Before we jump right into it, I got a question for you. How many of you enjoy all-you-can-eat buffets? Okay, let's break it down. How many of you like the Chinese all-you-can-eat buffet? Okay. Anybody been to, was it over there in the Beltline, Chowking? I heard that's a big Chinese buffet. How many of you prefer all-you-can-eat pizza buffets? Some of you are raising your hand on all of them. There was a place I used to eat a lot when I lived out in Las Vegas that was all-you-can-eat sushi. Some of you may or may not like sushi, raw fish. I love sushi. My oldest daughter, Kaylee, who turned 20 years old this week. That's crazy. 20-year-old, happy birthday to Kaylee. She loves sushi, so that's kind of her and I thing in the family. We both love sushi. Problem with sushi is you can eat all you can eat, and then like 30 minutes later, you're hungry again. But all you can eat sushi. How many of you prefer the king of all you can eat buffets, the Golden Corral? You're a fan of the Golden Corral? Put your hand up. So I'm thinking, when you're filling out life insurance policy forms, I've seen a lot of things you have to indicate. Do you smoke? Yes or no. Do you drink? Yes or no. How often do you drink if you drink? But I'm thinking when you're filling out those life insurance policies that maybe one of the questions should be, how often do you eat at the Golden Corral? Which may be a bigger threat than any of the above. We have our men's prayer breakfast at the Golden Corral, which, by the way, when you go to the Golden Corral at 8:30 on a Saturday morning, the dessert bar is open. Like, how can you beat the Golden Corral, wide open dessert bar? They've got all kinds of things at the Golden Corral buffet at 8:30 on a Saturday morning. You can eat fried fish. You can eat fried shrimp. You can eat pizza. You can eat, I would say broccoli, but it doesn't seem like anybody really touches the broccoli. But there's all kinds of things you can eat outside of breakfast world. I wasn't as concerned about the dessert bar being open at 8:30 on a Saturday morning as I was the fact that half of the desserts were half gone at 8:30 on a Saturday morning. So that either says something about the people eating at 8:30 on Saturday morning, or what they do with the food on Friday night before the Saturday morning. I'm not sure which. I was struggling with my weight a little bit, and so I went to the doctor. He said, Devin, what you need to do is you need to do 25 crunches every day. And so I did that for a while, but I have to tell you, like, that's a lot of chocolate. I got up to like 12, then I had to go to the minis. Man, I felt good, but my diabetes was off the charts after that little experiment. Somebody would get that later. Red wrapper, crunch, bar. Just laugh like I'm funny. It'll help you. There was a place when I lived in Las Vegas where you could go on Thursday night, locals could eat all-you-could-eat crab legs. Like, you can't beat that. All-you-could-eat crab legs. But the manager there was so rude. I mean, I'm talking like once an hour he would come out and look at you like, why are you still here? After like four visits from the manager, you feel guilty and you finally leave. I guess it's not all-you-can-eat, but all-you-can-eat in a four-hour window. I did see a picture one time that reminded me of that very thing. I love this. At the Chinese restaurant, all-you-can-eat buffet, not mean all-day buffet. You know, come stay 4 hours. You eat, you go home. I love that. I love that sign. That is so awesome. Today we are talking about all-you-can-eat fish and chips, which, by the way, if you're pastoring a church that out front of the church has one of those marquee signs that you change the words and the phrases every week, if you're going to preach on John 6, don't put on the sign this weekend at church, all you can eat, fish and chips. I learned that lesson the hard way. That was the name of my sermon, but people in the community thought it wasn't a sermon title. They thought it was all you could eat, fish and chip. So we had an extra large crowd that week that was a little disappointed that what I meant was I was teaching, not providing food. This is one of the most popular miracles in the Bible. It's actually recorded in all four Gospels. It's one of the only ones recorded in all four Gospels. It takes place on a hillside in the eastern shores of the Sea of Galilee. Let me set the stage for you. John chapter 6, verse 1. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him. Why were they following? Because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, which has some significance in and of itself. It's a common theme in the Bible, and going up in the mountain means meeting with God and the authority that comes from that meeting. So Jesus goes up to the mountain. There he sat down, which also is a sign of authoritative teaching. He sat down with his disciples. Three little words here at the beginning of verse 4, which are extremely important to understanding this story. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. So we set the stage from the Gospel of John and from the other Gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We discover that Jesus has just learned of the execution of John the Baptizer. The forerunner that went ahead of him was taken captive, and if you know the story, eventually John literally lost his head. He was decapitated by the evil ruler, and Jesus and his disciples have just learned of the death of John the Baptist, and they've retreated. They've retreated to rest and recover. They are peopled out. You ever been there? You ever been peopled out? Tired of shaking hands? Tired of talking? My views on people out is a lot shorter than my wife's. She can go on and on and on and on and on, talking and communicating and having a good time. I call it flapping. She can go on and on flapping, even when we have to be somewhere or do something. My people fuse is a little shorter. I get peopled out quicker. I'm a little more introverted than she is. But Jesus and his disciples were peopled out. And so they retreated to the mountains to rest and recover. But the crowds will not leave Jesus alone. There's an excitement with following Jesus, the signs, the wonders, the miracles. And so the crowds follow Jesus out to this remote area. A minimum of 5,000 people are there. Most New Testament scholars believe it was probably somewhere closer to 10 to 20,000 people, which, considering that day and age where an average village was about 2,000 or 3,000 people, a lot of little villages around the Sea of Galilee, it means that a lot of people from a lot of different villages are making their way out to Jesus. The people traveled a long way. If you go back and put this story in context of where Jesus was, they were traveling up to 10 miles on foot to hear Jesus and to watch Jesus perform miracles. Now, the little phrase I pointed out is a very important one, that the Passover is at hand. Passover is a significant celebration, a significant Jewish holiday. It's kind of the Super Bowl of the Jewish holidays in Jesus' time. It symbolizes the Exodus event. When the people were held captive by the Egyptians and Moses, the great deliverer, came in and brought the people out, the Exodus event of coming out of Egypt and making their way through the desert toward the Promised Land, the Passover was the celebration, the annual celebration of that event. The words Passover symbolize that night. If you know, remember the story when Moses predicted the plagues, and the very last plague was that the oldest son of every household would die. But those that sacrificed the lamb and applied the blood on the doorpost, the blood of the lamb, the angelic, the angel of death, would pass over those homes. And so that's where the name Passover came from. And they celebrated Passover every year. Hundreds of thousands of Jews from all over the world literally would converge on Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. Again, it was a really big deal. And so the intentionality of John in chapter 6 to echo the themes of Exodus demonstrate to us how Jesus was the ultimate fulfiller of Passover. That Jesus is the greater Moses. That he's greater than Moses. There's two themes in John chapter 6 that echo what happened back to the Israelites during the Passover season. We'll see next Sunday that God controls the waters, that Jesus will walk on the water, which echoes back to when the Israelites were leaving the land of Egypt and they came face to face with their first obstacle, the Red Sea. And what happened? God came down and he parted the Red Sea so that they would pass over on dry land. And it was the theme of the Israelites when they worshiped at Passover, that they would celebrate the God who controls the waters. In John chapter 6, the insider, the best friend of Jesus, says, I'll tell you who controls the waters. Jesus himself controls the waters as he walks on water to his followers. Jesus is the God who controls the seas. We also see in John chapter 6 that God provides bread. Jesus will say, I am the bread of life. In a couple of weeks, we'll see that text. If you remember the Exodus story, it was God who provided bread for his people when they were in the desert, when they were out of food, when they were grumbling and complaining, where are we going to get bread? God sent heavenly bread, manna, from heaven that they would gather every morning. In John chapter 6, we discover that Jesus is the true bread of life. And that Jesus doesn't just provide physical nourishment from day to day, but Jesus provides eternal life. He provides spiritual nourishment to his children. And so this narrative in John chapter 6 reminds us that Jesus is the new Moses, that he is the greater Moses, that he superseded Moses, that he is the great deliverer who would bring deliverance to our souls, who would provide spiritual nourishment to our souls. Deuteronomy chapter 18 spoke of a prophet who would one day come, who would be the great prophet, who was beyond Moses and bigger than Moses and more important than Moses. And Jesus, through John, is demonstrating in chapter 6 that he is that prophet, that he is the great prophet, that he is the great deliverer, that he is the one who superseded Moses. If you were here last Sunday, you remember at the end of John chapter 5 when Jesus was calling the witnesses. The last witness that he called was the scriptures to testify that he is the Son of God. And from the pages of the scriptures, Jesus called a witness. You remember who it was? It was Moses, right? And Jesus told the religious leaders, you don't believe Moses, because if you believe Moses, you would believe in me. And now John 6 continues that theme to say, Moses testifies of who Jesus is, and Jesus is the greater Moses. And so when John mentions Passover, it's not just a, hey, let me add this little side note. John mentions Passover as an important reminder that Jesus is creating and Jesus is fulfilling images from Israel's sacred past. The Exodus event, we already saw it in John the Baptizer, didn't we? When they said, who is Jesus? And John said, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. John the Baptizer was already pointing to Jesus as the fulfillment of the Exodus event, the fulfillment of the sacrificial lamb, that Jesus is the Lamb of God. So it's interesting that this crowd of 10 to 20,000 people who should be in Jerusalem celebrating Passover, instead they have gathered to see and hear Jesus, who they don't even realize is the fulfillment of Passover. Picture the scene. Jesus and his disciples, they retreat to rest, to mourn the loss of John the Baptizer, to refresh their spiritually nourished bodies and souls. And these large crowds, hoping for miracles, follow them out. They're waiting in anticipation. We learn from the other gospel writers that they stay there all day, and they have nothing to eat. Evening approaches. They have traveled many miles on foot. They are exhausted. They are tired. They are hungry, and they are a long way from home. Sounds like they're being set up for a Snickers commercial, right? They are tired. They are cranky. Anybody get tired and cranky when you get hungry? Angry? Lash out at people? I need pizza right now. These people are Snickers candidates. They are transforming into angry people, no doubt, by this time of the day. And they are a long way from home. Recipe for disaster. Well, what happens next? I think most of us know the rest of the story, but let's read it. John chapter 6, verse 5. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, and it was an angry, cranky crowd. Maybe this is why Jesus responded the way he did. Large crowds coming toward him. Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" And he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii, which is about 8 months worth of wages, would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. So Philip says, we had 8 months worth of income. It wouldn't be enough to feed these people. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number, so just the men was equivalent to 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, and that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So amidst this angry crowd, the disciples locate a boy with a sack lunch. 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. And from this small lunch, Jesus works a miracle. He divides the crowd, has them seated, and then he prays over the food. Blesses the food. I find that interesting from the text, that Jesus prayed over food that wasn't even there yet, as far as we know. I mean, what are the people thinking in that moment? Like, what is he praying for? We have 5 loaves of bread. There's 10,000 of us. What is Jesus praying for? Blessing food that they do not have. And then he works a miracle, right? We're not sure if the miracle happened as they were distributing the food or when Jesus broke the bread. Suddenly it was all there as they went, if the miracle was occurring. We don't get those type of details. But either way, we know a miracle happens. The buffet is open and everyone gets fed. Now let me make some important observations about this story from this text. The first thing I want to say about this text and this story is that we are to never assess life's difficulties in light of our own resources. Never assess life's difficulties, life's struggles, life's realities in light of your own resources. There's a huge problem in this text. There are thousands of hungry people and a few morsels of food. That's a problem. You ever been in that situation? You ever been in a situation where a lot of people are trying to eat and you don't think or are unsure if there's going to be enough? Sometimes if you go to certain pizza buffets, that's an issue. If you're there right at lunch and there's not enough pizzas out and suddenly you're looking around at the amount of people and the amount of pizza, and then what happens when they bring out that fresh pizza? Like everybody's chumbling their way up to the pizza buffet and they're elbowing and trying to get in. And then you're watching that person that's going to pull 6 pieces off the pizza, right? When there's 20 angry people waiting for that one pizza. And why do the pizza places always bring the worst pizza whenever you're waiting? It's like the cheese with nothing but pineapple. Hey, let's get creative. No, we want meat supreme pizza. Bring it now. So maybe that's just my own internal issues, but these people are angry and they're cranky and they're looking around thinking, how are we going to eat? And Jesus uses this moment to teach his disciples a lesson. He wants to expand their understanding and expand their trust in his sufficiency and his power. And he uses this moment to test them. Look at it again in verse 5. Lifting up his eyes, he sees this large crowd was coming. Jesus says to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Look at the next phrase. He said this to test him, for he knew what he would do. Jesus knew what he was going to do, but he wanted to test the faith of his disciples. And Philip is the guinea pig. How did the guinea pig become the euphemism for being a test subject? I don't know. They only test things on mice, mainly, and other animals. Did they used to use the guinea pig? I don't know. This is where my mind goes while I'm teaching. Why is the guinea pig the euphemism? But Philip is the guinea pig. He's the test subject. And what we learn from Philip and Andrew, Peter's brother, is how we are not to respond in these situations, even though they respond naturally. The first thing we see is the Philip response. What did Philip say? Verse 7, Philip answered him, 200 denarii, which again, 8 months worth of wages, would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. The Philip response always asks the question, how much? How much do we need? It requires no faith. It's a visible, he needs visible evidence. From this text and other texts about Philip, we know Philip was a bean counter. He was the human calculator. He was the cash register. He was the one thinking, lots of people, no food, not enough money. He does the math in his head. And he says, Jesus is not possible. The numbers do not add up. Nerd alert. Philip's in the room, right? Numbers do not make sense. Jesus, we need 8 months of wages. I've done the calculation just here in my head. How much do we need? We need 8 months worth of wages to even think about feeding this people. Philip, the human calculator, wants to know how much. By the way, to all of those 1980s teachers who told me when I was doing math, Devin, you need to learn how to do math without a calculator, because you're not always going to have your calculator with you. To all of those teachers from the 1980s, I say to you, bam! I have a calculator with me all the time. Do not use that, students. Respect your teachers. You need to learn math without a calculator. How much, Philip says? How much? How much do we need? How much? Second response was from Andrew, who was always bringing people to Jesus. Andrew's the one that finds the young boy with the lunch. Andrew's response was more of a how response. Verse 8 and 9. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" The Andrew response asks how. A little bit of faith, but he can't see what is past his own hands. At least he makes the effort. At least they scour the crowd looking to address the problem. But the problem is they only come up with a few biscuits and sardines, right? A small lunch. And he brings that to Jesus. Here's what we have, but it's not much. How are we going to feed this crowd with this little amount? He is baffled by the circumstances. Why? Because the problem seems really big and the solution seems really small. Now let's be honest. Andrew and Philip are us. These are legitimate questions. These are legitimate concerns. I identify with Andrew and Philip. If there were 10,000 people in this room, and you said to me, "Devin, here's what we have to feed them," I would say, how are we going to feed them? How much would it take to feed 10,000 people? Now, this is a Zach Hudson lunch. Okay, this is literally a lunch that I would make for my son, Zach. First thing we notice about it requires two bags, because one bag's not enough to hold his food in. The bottom of the bag breaks. Anyone else have to double bag their kids' lunches? And this is also, the reason we're even using a bag is because Zach does not have a lunch box. The last 2 years of school, within the first 3 days of school, I said that, did you hear me say it? 3 days of school, Zach lost his lunchbox. I didn't say 3 months. I didn't say toward the end of the school year. It was beaten and tattered and holding on by a thread because of the maximum amount of use that had taken place over the course of a school year. I said within the first 3 days of school, not 1 year, but two consecutive years, a boy who was in the eighth grade and the ninth grade lost his lunchbox. So this year, I said to Zach, do you want a lunchbox? And he said, no, I'm just going to stick with the bags. I'm kind of known as the bag guy now. So this is the bag guy's lunch. Always in the lunch, there's something to drink, so a bottle of water. Okay. There's chips for Zach. You always want, this is one lunch, by the way. Two oats and honey crunch bars. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich. This is a legitimate peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Does anyone feel the need to want to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich while I'm teaching? I'll give it to you, I will. Andy? There you go. Oh, sorry, Dixie, right in the face. I'm just kidding. We have Swiss cake rolls. Whoop, whoop, little Debbie. We have some type of fruit, normally grapes, apple, something. This is one lunch for a hungry teenage boy. This is more lunch than what they had that day. One bag was required in the day of Jesus. Not two bags. It wasn't enough to require two bags. And this one bag, this one lunch, five barley loaves, which barley was the bread of the poor, five barley loaves from a poor boy and two fish is all they had. I identify with Philip and Andrew because the resources seem so small, but the problem seems so big. Have you ever felt that way about life? The resources seem so small. The problem seems so big. You ever felt that way in your marriage? The resources, what I'm working with in my marriage, me as a person, I can't seem to get it right. My resources seem so small and our marriage problems seem so huge. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to work out the issues. You ever felt that way about your finances? The problem seems so big and the resources seem so limited. You ever felt that way about parenting? Raising kids in the culture that we live in. My resources as a parent seem so limited. Half the time I think, man, I suck as a dad. I suck as a parent. I'm not very good at what I do. I don't think I'm a great parent, and the issue seems so really big. Ever felt like your resources seem very limited in your marriage, your finances, life, your future? Never evaluate life's difficulties in light of your own resources. Why? Because when we look at life's problems through human eyes, we only see what humans can do. We only see human solutions. And in those instances, how and how much are legitimate questions. How are we going to make it? How much is it going to require? How is our marriage ever going to find healing? How am I ever going to go to college? How am I ever going to make it in this job? How am I ever going to pay the bills? How much is necessary to make ends meet every month? How could we ever tithe with this amount coming in and this amount going out? How and how much are legitimate questions? Our reality as Jesus followers is this. We are not restricted to human resources. our God can feed multitudes from mere morsels. Now, let's not beat ourselves up too bad when we struggle with how and how much, because the disciples at this point in the game have been with Jesus for over 2 years. They've watched him perform miracles. They have seen him perform extraordinary God-only type actions again and again and again and again. They've been with Jesus, and yet they can't see beyond their own resources because their view of Jesus is still defective. They still underestimate who Jesus is. Man, that is such a common issue for us who claim to follow Jesus. No matter how long we've walked with Jesus, our tendency is still to underestimate who Jesus is. And how many times has God been testing us and we fall back on how much or how? And we underestimate the provision, the ability, and here's an important one, and the desire of God to help his children. The faith struggle is real, isn't it? I mean, that's what bridges this gap. What bridges the gap between the problem seems really big and the resources seem really small, that's the faith issue. And the faith struggle is real because we have limits and God does not. And faith bridges that gap. And the size of the task is not the factor. The size of God is the factor. Will I trust him? Will I trust him? As you have heard me say before at City Church, in the midst of crisis, in the midst of problems, in the midst of difficulties, we find ourselves often asking the wrong question. The question is not how, the question is not how much, the question is who. Who do I trust him? Who do I follow? Who do I serve? Who is this God I claim to know? Who is he? John says the purpose of this whole thing was to test. Now, the purpose of a test is supposed to be for learning. I'm not sure that's always what happens when we test, but the purpose of testing in school and other places is for learning. And God tests. He tests us to challenge our faith. It's a learning process. Will I trust him even when it doesn't make sense to do so? Here's the gospel in this. Don't miss it. Grace overcomes that lack of faith. When we can't trust him deep enough, when we can't trust him enough, when we fall back on our hows and how much, I am so thankful for the gospel, for the grace of Jesus that says, Devin, I got you. I got you. I know your faith is limited. I know your instinct is how and how much. I've got you. That's the gospel. Don't assess life's difficulties in light of our small human resources. Here's the other thing I want to leave with us. God often uses the small. He often uses the insignificant to accomplish the great. I love what Jesus does here. I love that he uses a small boy with a sack lunch amidst 10,000 people. A small boy with a sack lunch to teach a lesson. Now, isn't this so common in the Bible? It was a shepherd boy that stood before a warrior, a trained warrior. It was a shepherd boy that stood before him and said, look, I don't have resources to draw upon. I'm a shepherd boy with a sling, but you know what I do have? A God who's bigger than you. Jesus takes a small boy, and it reminds us of God's call, of John's call in his gospel to believe, and his provision for those who believe. Well, what is our role in this? It's demonstrated by the boy. Our role is to offer, it's to give, to offer what we have to God. This boy gives Jesus his lunch. Now, don't miss this. The boy's hungry too. He's been there all day. The boy is also hungry. He has barley loaves. I told you that's poor people food. Just like a whole side note here we don't have time to get into that we've touched on in John's gospel before, and that's the continual compassion of Jesus upon the poor, the tired, and the hungry. But Jesus doesn't stop and say, are you guys, what's wrong with you? Well, you didn't bring lunch? Man, what are you thinking? You walked all the way out in the desert. You're 10 miles from home. The sun's setting. Where's your food? Jesus doesn't condemn them. He has compassion on them. He teaches a lesson to his disciples and, in the process, feeds a hungry crowd who will turn on him in a moment when they understand what he's really teaching. But Jesus feeds them, knowing they're going to turn on him, knowing they're going to walk away from him. There's people in this crowd that claim to be disciples of Jesus, that claim to be followers of Jesus, that will learn at the end of chapter 6, walk away from him because they can't handle his teaching. Jesus knows all of this. And yet he feeds them. He has compassion on them. He loves on them. He gives them more than what is required. Offer what you have to Jesus. You say, Devin, I don't have much. I'm not talented. I'm not smart. I don't have a lot of money. I don't have much. What God says to us is we offer what we have. Because ultimately this is an issue about who's on the throne of my heart. Who's in control of my life? Our role is to offer, to give. God's role is to provide. He's the provider. And he provides from his abundant supply of grace. He is the provider. He transforms a little into a lot. Jesus, listen, don't miss this in the text. It's so important. Jesus creates leftovers. How many of you like leftovers? Be careful about this and on leftovers. 12 baskets. Hello. You're like eating leftovers for months. Like, we're not huge leftover fans at my house, if I'm being honest. Leftovers sit in my fridge for a while, but rarely do they get eaten. But they sit there. We can't get a gallon of milk in our fridge because we got some leftovers. But now, when I was growing up, some of you are like me, leftovers turned into a magical dish at the end of the week called a casserole. Whatever we had that week became a casserole. Hello, it's leftovers. Man, it was really bad when we had spaghetti and green beans in the same week. But Jesus created leftovers. He wants to pour out grace upon grace upon grace upon grace, 12 baskets of leftovers. You hear a lot of people speculate, why 12 baskets? Well, that's one for each of the disciples to walk home with, being reminded of Jesus' test. We don't really know why the 12 baskets happened. That kind of sounds cool, but what we do know is that Jesus poured out more than what was required, more than what was necessary, grace upon grace upon grace to people who are about to walk away from him. Isn't that the gospel? Grace upon grace upon grace. And I believe that God often uses things that are so small so that he gets the glory. So it's not about us, and it's not about our talents, and it's not about our abilities. It's about the God that we serve. Two challenges for us from the text. One, look beyond your situation to the solution. Look beyond your current situation to the solution. Look to Jesus. He is enough. He is more than enough. Look beyond your situation to the solution. Devin, you don't understand about my marriage. I don't. Devin, you don't understand about my work. I don't. Devin, you understand this person that gets on my nerves. I don't. Devin, you understand my in-laws. I don't. But look beyond your situation to the solution. Devin, you understand this war that goes on inside my heart and head. I don't. But look beyond your situation to the solution. Look to Jesus. He is more than enough. And then our second challenge from the text, which is even bigger at times, is that we are to offer what we have. Listen to me. It may not seem like a lot, but it's what Jesus wants. You say, Devin, all I have is a broken heart. That's okay. Offer it to him. You say, Devin, all I have is an empty bank account. That's okay. Offer it to him. You say, Devin, all I have is a wounded soul. That's okay. He is the God of the brokenhearted. Offer it to him. You say, Devin, all I have are limited resources. That's okay. offer him what you have. You say, Devin, I have nothing. Hello? That's all of us. There's nothing that any of us can bring that God's going to be like, wow, now I'm impressed. Well, I didn't know you were bringing those abilities to the table. What? Are you kidding me? Look at the size of this bank account. Now I can do something. Look, everything we bring, the New Testament is clear, the Old Testament is clear even. Everything we bring is nothing. We bring nothing to the gospel. We are sinners. And while we were sinners, Christ died for us. We bring nothing to the table. We do not bring our righteousness. We do not bring our goodness. We do not bring, look how much better I am than that person. We bring nothing to the table. That's the beauty of the gospel. Paul said it this way, in my strength, in my weaknesses, he is known. In my weaknesses, I am made strong in him. What is considered a weakness to you? Offered to Jesus is where Jesus shines most clearly. Look, this story ends in such a weird way. Look how the crowd responds. 14, when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet. There's Deuteronomy 18. This is the prophet who has come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdraws again to the mountain by himself. This crowd wants to make Jesus a king. They want to replace the Caesar head on their coins with the head of Jesus. They want to make Jesus their king. After all, he can meet all their needs. He can heal their sick. He can feed their hungry bellies. He can meet their needs. They want to use Jesus for their own agenda. There's a bunch of political activists in the crowd. Let's make Jesus our king. Does that sound relevant? And there's nothing that drives me crazier than people evoking the name of Jesus for their own political agenda. Like, don't bring Jesus into this. That's not gospel. We see it being played out right now, don't we? Right now, in Charlottesville, we see it being played out. Bringing the name of Jesus into it, like it's a Jesus thing. All the way back to John 6. Let's make Jesus king. But Jesus doesn't fit their agenda. He is forced to withdraw from the crowd because he is not what they are looking for. He is not a magic genie. He is not a bellhop that is at our beckoning call. He is not an earthly king who will be used to overthrow the Romans and meet their earthly needs. Jesus does not fit in our agenda. Don't miss it. Jesus is a king. He's the King of Kings. But he's not the type king that they were searching for. He's not the type king that fits in their plans. He's not the type king that fits their agenda. You know why? Jesus will not share his throne. He demands all of us offer what you have. He wants to be the king of our lives. He wants to be our highest priority. Why? What's the reason? Because he knows that in him is where we find our ultimate fulfillment. We'll see it in 2 weeks, that he is the bread of life. He is the one who brings eternal nourishment to our hungry souls. He wants to be a king. He is a king. But he wants to be the king of your heart, of your life. I've told you that the sin of idolatry still permeates everything we do. What am I choosing in this moment over Jesus? That's my idol. That's the king of my life in that moment. And Jesus will not share his throne. He withdraws from the crowd and says, I'm not what you're looking for. As a matter of fact, we'll see how clearly he says it. If you want to read ahead and do your homework and read ahead John 6, you'll find out what Jesus is about to do. Let me end with this. Time is over. There was a well-known preacher of previous century, a guy by the name of L.R. Scarborough. who would preach massive events with large crowds of people, and this gospel message was very clear that we are to offer who we are and what we have to Jesus. And one night at one of his events, as L.R. Scarborough was preaching, when he came to the end of his message, he was kind of the old school way where people would come down to the front and pray, and still wish we sometimes would go back to that, but people would come, make their way to the altar and pray and offer what they have to God. And Scarborough noticed, he had noticed while he was teaching, that there was a young man in the audience that obviously was physically disabled, that he didn't have arms, but he had just the little hands that had grown from his shoulders where his arms were supposed to be, and he was missing legs. And this again was a previous century, and so technology was not what we have today. And he basically made his way around, pushing himself on this kind of little scooter that was just right floor level, almost like a mechanic uses to get under a car. And he would push himself around and scoot himself around in and out of the crowd and pull himself up in his seat. And Scarborough noticed that when he taught and offered for us to give who we are to Jesus, that this young man made his way down onto that little scooter and worked his way as close to the front as he could, where he began to pray. And Scarborough left his podium, and he went to where this young boy was. And he knelt down beside him and said to him, "Son, I've noticed that you've come today. How can I help you? How can I pray for you?" And the young man looked up at Scarborough and said to him, "Dr. Scarborough, can God use half a man? Can God use half a man?" And Scarborough looked back at the young man and he said these words, "Son, God can use half a man who is wholly surrendered to him, but God can never use a whole man who is only half surrendered to him." We offer what we have. Devin, you don't get, I don't. But what all of us bring to the table in the story of the Bible is nothing. That our righteousness is as filthy rags, the Bible says. And that's the good news, because Jesus comes to us right where we are in life. He feeds the hungry crowd right where they are in life. He comes to us where we are, with grace upon grace upon grace. And he meets us where we are, and he provides nourishment and fulfillment to our hungry souls, because he is King of Kings, and he will not share his throne with our agendas and our plans and our bank accounts and our talents. We bring nothing to the table, and that's exactly what Jesus requires.